15. Borlias Occupation, Day 47. It was the dead of night, but the former biotics facility was never truly asleep. Tam could hear movement down side corridors, distant conversations, a rumble in the walls that signified the takeoff of a patrol of starfighters outside. But this corridor was comparatively still. Guarded day and night against entry by unauthorized personnel, it was empty of traffic at this hour. Tam paused outside the door to Danny Quee's laboratories and felt himself rocking in place, moved by the racing of his heart. But pausing was failure to comply, and the faintest throbs of a new headache joined the rhythm of his heart. He cursed and moved to the wall opposite the doorway. Reaching up, he brushed his fingers along the wall's surface, near the ceiling, until he found it. A slick patch, as though someone had sprayed oil there. It wasn't oil. It was a thing of the Yuuzhan Vong, another living apparatus that they had given him. It had a texture much like the villip, smooth, slick. He rubbed it until he found the crease that was its activation point, and he stroked that more deliberately. Then he wiped his hand on his shirt. That spot on the wall changed color. Though he knew it remained flat as a sheet of fine flimsyplast, it seemed to him as though it gained depth, transforming into a duplicate of the security keypad and blue readout beside Danny's door. As though it were a hollow recording, a hand came into view and punched numbers into the keypad. It was a woman's hand, young, unlined, probably Danny's. Tam watched the keys as they were depressed, memorizing the sequence, and glanced at the readout that showed the values of the keys. They weren't the same. He repeated the letters and numbers he'd seen pressed, and they differed from the ones on the readout in two places. That meant what? Either he'd misread the keys as they were being punched, or the readout played back an incorrect sequence. He nodded, satisfied. It was a security measure. A recording of the readout would yield a password that either wouldn't work or would alert a security office of an intrusion in progress. Only Tam's visual memory, very strong and accurate, one of the reasons he'd become a holocam operator in the first place, had saved him from being trapped by this subterfuge. He wished he'd been trapped. He wished he'd failed. The headache began to increase in intensity. He touched the Yuuzhan Vong recording apparatus and watched it fade away to transparency. Then he keyed the password, the correct password, into the keypad. The door slid aside. Tam froze. Inside the room, 2 meters from him, Danny Quee sat at her usual desk, but she was motionless, her head down, colors from the monitor before her playing across her hair. Danny didn't move other than from the rhythm of her breathing, and Tam forced himself to enter the office. It was dim, lit only by monitors and desk lights, and no one other than Danny was present. Tam moved around her station to stand beside her, taking great care not to brush against anything. If he moved slowly enough, he could compensate for his awkwardness. Awkwardness that had caused him to trip when he was being pursued on Coruscant. Awkwardness that had led to his capture, his enslavement. Danny's monitor showed something, an object with facets like a gem. There was a lot of writing on the screen, technical terminology he couldn't grasp, phrases like reflectivity index and refraction and power augmentation. He squinted at it. His eyes were fine, but he had to squint to alert the little creature, now sharing his ocular orbit with his eye, that now was the time for it to wake up and begin recording. He felt the thing twitch. Then his stomach twitched as nausea rose within him. Tam moved through the laboratory, looking at each of the other screens in turn, looking at handwritten notes and datapad screens. At the station beside Danny's lay a couple of data cards. Slowly, silently, he brought out his own datapad, inserted the cards in it, copied off their contents, and returned them to their original positions. There was nothing more to do here. He felt his headache rise in strength. No, there was something more he could do here. His orders were to acquire information and to aid the Yuuzhan Vong in general in any way he could that did not lead to his capture and exposure. Danny Kui was here. Tam could overpower her while she slept. She was an enemy of the Yuuzhan Vong, and eliminating her as a new Republic resource would definitely help his masters. There was no way he could smuggle her out of the biotics building, no way he could even smuggle her out of this hallway. No, to eliminate her as a threat, he'd have to kill her. He could do it, too, in such a way that there would be no likelihood of blame falling on him. In one of his pockets was a gob of material restraining a razor bug. He could pull it out, free the creature, fling it at Danny. It would chew her to pieces. And he'd go back to the shuttle and receive praise. He stood in place, and his headache mounted. He cursed himself. Just by thinking of a way to help the Yuuzhan Vong, he'd obligated himself to do it, or suffer the consequences. Danny Kui had to die now. He stood behind her. He didn't bother wondering what might have been had they met in different circumstances. He was a big, clumsy, inarticulate thing, and she was an intelligent, beautiful woman with the stamp of destiny on her. Had they been stranded together on an otherwise deserted planet, nothing would have happened between them. They would have ended up friends, just good friends. Tam reached out a hand to brush it ever so carefully against one of her blonde curls, now colored scarlet by light from the screen before her. Then he reached into his pocket and found the razor bug. He stood and did nothing. The pain increased until it affected his breathing, making it short and halting. The problem was, no matter how much he wanted the pain to end, he knew it would keep coming. He knew that Danny Kui deserved to live. He knew that he deserved to die. He turned away. Pain shot through him, as though a metal spike had been hammered through both his temples with a single blow. He staggered and had to put a hand on the floor to keep from falling over. But the pain didn't kill him. He strained against it, rose, made it as far as the door. He had to lean for long moments against the door jamb to give himself strength enough to continue. Then he could open the door and leave. As he walked, his steps made unrhythmic by the hammering within his skull, he reminded himself that he was taking data to his controller. He was succeeding in his primary mission, and the pain diminished, but only a little. As soon as the door slid shut behind Tam, Danny raised her head to stare after him. She typed a command into her keyboard. The screen before her changed views to follow Tam as he staggered away down the corridor. When he was well out of earshot, she keyed her comlink. "He's gone," she whispered. "He was either memorizing or recording everything on our screens." Iella's voice came back, not a whisper, but the comlink's volume was dialed down low. "Did he leave anything?" "I don't know. I'll begin analyzing the recordings now. Out." "Good work. Out." Danny brought up the first of the recordings made by the holocams positioned at hidden points around the room. She felt her shoulders twitch. She wasn't sure what Tam had been up to in the long minutes he stood directly behind her, and was desperate to be sure that he hadn't spread Yuuzhan Vong creatures throughout this office. Yuuzhan Vong worldship, Coruscant Orbit. In the operations chamber, surrounded by analysts and advisors, blaze bug displays and recording creatures, banks of villips and standing rows of guards, Savong La sat at the center of things and listened to reports. Most of them came from Maul Law and Vicky Shesh. As they spoke, Savong La reflected that some things never changed. Normally it would be Nomanor and Verger standing before him, interpreting, offering advice, sniping at one another. One of them a Yuuzhan Vong warrior, and the other a clever female of a lesser species. Now, with Nolmanor and Vergeir performing other tasks, their roles were still being acted out by others. "It is a super weapon," Maulaw said, using the basic word rather than the Yuuzhan Vong equivalent. "They have a history of creating devices that can travel faster than light and smash entire worlds, and this is a new one." "It's Danny Kui's doing," Vicky said. "It has to be. She's the only one who could integrate Yuuzhan Vong and New Republic technology this way. I'm going to make that idiot Tam suffer for not killing her when he had the chance." Savong Law raised a finger. Vicky bit back on further ranting words. "I just heard heresy," Savong Law said. "First, the works of the Yuuzhan Vong are not technology. They must never be referred to as such." Apparently stricken, though Savong Law suspected it was merely acting, Vicky bowed her head. "I am sorry, War Master. I don't know a word to encompass both disciplines." "Perhaps during your punishment you will find one. Second, our works could not be melded with infidel technology. The gods would never allow it." Vicky and Maul Law exchanged glances, and it was Maul Law who dared to correct the War Master. "This turns out not to be correct. It has already been done. We know that some time ago, Anakin Solo reconstructed his lightsaber with a lambent crystal, and it appears that he passed knowledge of this technique to others before he was killed. It is also with a lambent crystal that this new device is concerned." "Go on." Maul Law gestured to Vicky. She turned to activate the recording creatures on the table behind her. Each in turn began to shine, the light above it showing one of the images Tam Elgrin had recorded. Maul Law pointed to the image that had been on Danny's screen. "That is a lambent crystal. Rather, it is a diagram of one. According to the information Vicky's agent seized, it is being artificially grown in a laboratory in the depths of their garrison building. According to other information we read in these images, they tried to grow the crystals on their ships, but they grow only in true gravity, or Dovin Basal gravity. Their infidel technology gravity ruins them." Savong Law offered Maul Law an expression of revulsion. "So their Jedi will have more lightsabers? We will not allow it." "It is worse than that, War Master. The diagram you see represents a lambent crystal as tall as one of our warriors." "As tall as... what sort of obscenity could they produce with such a..." And then Savong Law knew what they were producing. He found himself standing, shaking in anger, and did not remember rising. "Bring me my father's villip," he said. In moments he stared into the villip's blurry but recognizable simulation of his father's features. With impatience, Savong Law rushed through the customary greetings, then he got at the subject of his communication. "I now know what their Starlancer project is. It is another accursed superweapon. The coherent light these vehicles project to one another will at some point be focused through a giant lambent crystal being fabricated in the depths of their building. When this happens, the beam will be of sufficient power to destroy a world ship. The attack we suffered not long ago was a test firing, perhaps to attune the weapon's beam to the target." "Interesting," his father said. "We cannot allow them to perfect this device," the War Master continued. "So I now direct you to commit yourself to an all-out assault on that facility and destroy it immediately." Chulkong Law was silent for long moments. The villip representing his face froze into such immobility that Savong Law wondered if it had suffered some sort of failure. Then his father spoke again. "To do so would be a strategic mistake," Chulkong Law said. "We have not yet gauged our enemy's tactics or resources. His repertoire of surprises is not fully known. At best, our losses will probably be inappropriately high. At worst, with such a premature attack, we could sacrifice large numbers of warriors needlessly, and still lose. It is too early, my son.
My orders stand,
Savang La said.
His father's features assumed an expression that all but said, I expected better of you. It was an expression Chul Kong La wore whenever a student had failed him for the last time. It had never before been directed at Savang La, and the War Master took an involuntary step back. But Chul Kong La said nothing aloud, no words that would shame his son. Instead, he said, It will be done.
May the gods smile upon your actions, Savang La said.
He gestured at one of his officers, who stroked the villip. It inverted. The War Master stood, his breathing heavy. His father's final disapproval, so implacable, was like a physical blow to him. When he was under control again, he turned to Ma La.
Issue this directive. When Borlias falls to us, it will no longer be the home of the Kral. Instead, it will be given to the priests of Yun Yamka, a haven for their order, in thanks to the god for the gains he has brought us.
Ma La nodded. He too said, It will be done. That, the War Master thought, should send the priests of Yun Yuzhan into a fit, and if there truly are conspirators within their orders and the Shapers are against me, I will soon know it. He glanced down at his left arm. I will soon feel it.
Borlias Occupation, Day 48.
It has all the characteristics of a major push, Tycho said. He, Wedge, and Iella stood before the control chamber's hologram display. It showed the compiled readouts from all the garrison's ground-based sensors, including the gravitic sensors Luke's Jedi had planted in the jungle beyond the kill zone, and incorporated live feeds from starfighters out on patrol. At the center of the display was the large friendly signal marked Base. Out at a distance of a few hundred kilometers, in every direction of the compass, were masses of red blips. Iella counted 16 separate groups.
What are they doing? She asked.
One or two groups are landing personnel, vehicles, everything an invasion force needs, Wedge said. The others are distractions. We're supposed to divide up our attention among them in a desperate attempt to figure out where their landing zone is, and we're supposed to become nervous because we're not succeeding.
Supposed to, Iella said.
Meaning that you're not doing either one? Wedge shook his head. Oh, we're sending out scouts to all these sites, but they're under orders to show up, stay alert, and then make a run for it if anything comes after them. We don't want to lose pilots acquiring information we essentially don't need.
So you don't care where their landing zone is?
It doesn't matter.
Why?
Because sometime in the next day or two, they're going to attack us here. And that's exactly what we want them to do.
And when they do, Iella said, who are you going to face them with? The New Republic or the Rebel Alliance?
Wedge and Tycho exchanged a look, and both grinned.
Neither,
Wedge said. We're going to face them with an enemy they've never had the displeasure of fighting. We're going to hit them with the Empire.
They're not going to like the Empire, Tycho said.
And they told her about Operation Emperor's Hammer.
Borlias Occupation, Day 48.
This time, when the Millennium Falcon arrived on Borlias, it did so in the middle of the night, to no fanfare, no welcoming committee other than a handful of refuelers. Leia saw Han breathe a sigh of thanks, celebrating the absence of ceremony.
Han took Tark to find him some quarters. The rooms that had been assigned to the underage Jedi students, where Tark had previously been staying, would have been reassigned by now, and Han, though he liked the boy, didn't want him in their own quarters. Leia went in search of her daughter. Jaina's X-Wing was in the special operations docking bay, a mechanics crew working on it, but Leia could not find her daughter in her quarters or in the former incubation chamber that now served the special operations squadrons, Rogue, Wild Knights, Twin Suns, and Black Moon, as an informal lounge. Leia couldn't call Jaina on her comlink, couldn't give her the impression that she was keeping tabs, even though that's what she desperately wanted to do. Eventually, having had no luck in her search, she returned to her own quarters, and it was there she found Jaina, stretched out on the bed, lying on her side, in her pilot's jumpsuit, her boots and other accoutrements kicked off to the foot of the bed. Jaina was asleep, and Leia took a moment just to look at her. Though in engagement after engagement, Jaina had been at the controls of one of the New Republic's deadliest fighter craft, racking up kill after kill against savage enemies. Her features were now relaxed in sleep, and she looked as innocent as a child. But she was no child now. She was a young woman, her childhood suddenly irretrievably gone, and an ache constricted Leia's heart. "We should be away from all this now," she thought. "Han and Jaina and Jason and Anakin and I. And Luke and Mara and little Ben. In a field of flowers on Alderaan." Moving slowly and quietly so as not to awaken Jaina, Leia lay down on the bed and put an arm around her. It was the closeness, a protracted closeness, that Jaina no longer permitted her in times of wakefulness. Too soon she heard Jaina's breathing change as her daughter awakened. Jaina looked up into Leia's face and offered a slight, sleepy smile. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to wake you." "It's all right." Jaina reached up to pull Leia's arm more tightly around her. "Since you left, I've come here sometimes because I knew I could smell you and Dad here. You'd be all around me even when you weren't here." Leia managed to keep an expression of incredulity off her face. Those words seemed so unlike Jaina, so unlike the person she'd become across the last couple of years. "Are you all right?" Jaina shook her head. "I don't think so." She lay her head down on the pillow again. "I don't think I know who I am anymore." "Is it this goddess thing?" "No, that doesn't confuse me in the least. It's just a confidence game. No, the problem is all being a Jedi, which seems so crystal clear in what you should do and what you should say at any given time, and then being the rest of me where nothing is clear." Her expression, what Leia could see of it at this angle, seemed bleak. Leia chuckled. "Jaina, I've been wrestling with the same question since I was only a little older than you are now, and I still don't have a good answer. Sometimes I'm Jedi and sometimes I'm not. Jedi teaching says that you must turn away from fear. But as a politician, I have to experience fear, not just my own, the fear of my allies, the fear of my opponents. If I can't feel it, if I can't become it in a sense, I can't predict which way they're going to jump when trouble hits. Sometimes being a Jedi just runs completely counter to your other goals. The methodology is just too different." Softly, she stroked her daughter's hair, silently willing her daughter's torments away. "That's part of it, too," Jaina said. "It took me a while to figure it out. I'm afraid." "It's all right to be afraid. You're surrounded by fearsome things. Being afraid will keep you alive." Jaina shook her head. "That's not it. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of surviving and getting to the end of the war and discovering that I'm all alone, that everyone I knew and cared for is gone." "Jaina, that won't happen." "It's already been happening. I mean, it was like having part of me cut off when Anakin died. But with Jason, it's even worse. As far back as I can recall, no matter what was going on, no matter what was wrong, I could turn around and Jason would be there. We could be on some distant hideout world, or lost in the underbelly of Coruscant, or wandering around on parts of Yavin 4 no thinking creature has ever seen. And there Jason was. I never had to be bored. I never had to be afraid. I never had to be alone. When we lost him, I was cut in half. Half of me is gone.
Now the tears came. Jaina wiped them away. Leia shook her head.
Jason's not dead. I know he's in trouble, but he's alive. I would have felt him go. I felt it with Anakin.
The tension in Jaina's shoulders didn't ease, but she chose not to argue that point. Instead, she said,
I keep having these thoughts that I should be planning for the future. Just recently, they've gotten, well, even more frequent. But I can't bear to do that. I can't plan to have a home on a world where it might not be there tomorrow, or for a career in a service that might be gone, or to spend time with people who keep throwing themselves against the Vong until they stop coming back.
I know. That's what it was like all those years ago when Palpatine seemed to be an unstoppable force, and we were always on the run. And your father was just this ridiculously attractive man who always seemed to be on the verge of leaving us. And do you know what I learned?
What?
At times like that, you plan for your future by bringing people into your life. You know that they can't all survive what you're facing, but those who do, they're part of your life forever, no matter what. When you fall, they'll catch you. When you're hungry, they'll feed you. When you're hurting, they'll heal you. And you'll do the same for them. And that's your future. I've had whole worlds taken away from me, but not my future.
Jaina was silent, seemingly thinking about Leia's words for long moments. Finally, she rolled over onto her back to look into Leia's eyes.
Actually, I'm glad you got back tonight. Part of why I kept coming here was because I wanted to tell you something. I wanted to let you know that I finally get it.
You get... get what?
I had a talk with Mara a few days ago, and it really bothered me. It took me until after that really bad furball in space, the one where we almost lost Jag, to figure it out. I finally understood about you sending us, Jason and Anakin and me, away when we were little. Having to be away all the time, even when we were on Coruscant. I'm not stupid, I always knew why. Responsibilities.
Jaina looked off into the distance of time for a moment.
But I never really understood how badly it had to have hurt you.
Oh, baby, of course it hurt. I tried to tell you time after time. But there aren't even words for that kind of pain.
I know.
Jaina sat up and lay a letter. I've got to go. Reports to write. Got us stuff to do.
But first she embraced Leia, squeezing her with fierce strength.
I love you, Mom.
I love you, Jaina.
Borlias Occupation, Day 49. Wedge, in Luke's X-Wing, transcribed a lazy arc through vacuum in low planetary orbit. Far below was the near-continuous Borlias jungle. He gave the yoke a hard pull, and his course suddenly became a tight circle. He went through 360 degrees of arc, starry sky giving way to jungle outside his canopy, then becoming starfield again, as centrifugal force in excess of the X-Wing's inertial compensator tugged him deeper into the pilot's couch. He smiled as he leveled off.
Good to get out once in a while, even when you're not flying missions, isn't it?
R2-D2's beeps of response came across his comm board. They sounded like an agreement, but not an enthusiastic one.
Don't worry, R2. Luke will come back. There's no one in the galaxy who knows how to survive bad places better than Luke Skywalker.
R2-D2 beeped again, his tones sounding somewhat more encouraged. Then a voice broke over his comm system, Tycho's. "General, this is a heads-up."
"I radio."
"For the last half hour or so, we've had some odd traffic on the sensor board. Anomalous readings out beyond the kill zone, becoming more frequent."
"Your guess?"
"I'd say the push is on. They're coming in from all directions."
"About time. Alert Luke's team to prepare for departure. They'll leave during the confusion of the attack. I'm coming in."
Wedge put the X-Wing back on a course for the biotics building.
"You're sure about this?"
Luke gave Lando a skeptical look. Lando nodded, his manner easy.
"I'm sure. Every so often I need to remind the universe that I'm a damned good pilot. With people like you and Han and his daughter around, everyone tends to forget."
They stood in the killing field before the record time, the troop transport that had been part of the first invasion wave to reach the planet's surface. 7 weeks before, record time had been an antiquated cargo vessel, working reliably through late middle age. Then it had seen one combat mission, the Borlias landing, and had been shot nearly to pieces. Now, after weeks of, as time allows, repairs by the garrison's mechanics, the skin of its two main sections was so irregularly patched as to look scabrous, and reinforcing bars welded to the narrow section connecting the two ends merely accentuated the fact that the whole thing looked ready to break in half at any moment.
"Who are you trying to kid?" Luke gave him a skeptical look. "You're one of two men who blew up the second Death Star. You don't have anything to prove."
Lando shrugged. He ran a hand down his tunic to smooth it. It was a rust-red, long-sleeved garment, delightful to the touch, and had cost more than he'd made in lean years. It perfectly complemented the cream-colored hip cloak he wore. He wanted to look good for his funeral, or his triumphant return to Borlias, whatever would come.
"All right, you've got me. It's about the scam, Luke. People hear about me, they see what I do, and they think I'm all about the profit motive. And sure, I like wealth. I like it enough that sometimes I'll even do honest work to get it."
He offered Luke a mock shudder.
"But that's secondary. The trick is what makes everything sweet. Take someone who thinks he's got you, put him through the machinery of your mind and your skills, and bring him out the other end stripped of all his goods, but absolutely convinced that he's had the better of you, so convinced that he's even willing to be nice to you, to be generous to you, and you've accomplished something great."
He gestured at the ship. As if on cue, a hatch cover near the top of the bridge, beside one of the sensor arrays, popped free. It rolled down the bow's sloping hull and then dropped to the Duracrete with a tired clang.
"This is a scam. We're going to take this heap of junk in, and the Yuuzhan Vong are going to think our hopes are pinned on it. They're going to blow it up and think they've wrecked our hopes. They'll be doing exactly what we want them to. They'll be our personal servants for those few moments, which would kill them if they knew. And they'll never realize just how much they've helped us until we choose to tell them. That's sweeter than any wine, Luke."
"If you say so." Luke took a hard look at the bow, doubtless cataloging where the hatch came from so a repair crew could fix it in the little time they had left. "Who's your co-pilot on this?"
"No co-pilot, just a weapons officer, YVH-11A.
Luke frowned. "Isn't that one of your combat droids?"
"It is."
"You're going to use this mission to field test a droid."
"That's right."
"Not a good idea." Lando shrugged again.
"I'm captaining that flying landfill. My choice. Wedge has authorized it."
"Sometimes I think you're as crazy as Han." Luke checked his chrono.
"I'd better get with my team. Some last-minute packing to do."
"I'll be here." Lando watched Luke leave. He had no interest in field-testing his droids on a mission like this. No, he just had no faith in his ability to get out of this operation alive and didn't want to lead another living thing into death with him. That was bad, dark thinking. But he'd scammed Luke about his motives in having a droid weapons officer. He smiled to himself. Luke wasn't the naive young man he'd been when Lando had met him. Scamming him was tougher these days, and always a pleasure to pull off. He walked over to stand near the ramp into the bay he and his droids had occupied so many days ago. He stood well to the side of the sparks drifting out from the bay. He didn't want anything charring his tunic. The bay had now been partitioned off by a temporary bulkhead into two parts. In the front third, suspended in a metal brace hung from the bay ceiling, was a two-seat B-wing fighter, old but, he'd been guaranteed, reliable. The rear portion of the bay was filled with boulders. Well, they were not boulders, exactly. Hanging from cables were pieces of debris, many of them chunks of downed coral skippers, dead coral skippers, he reminded himself. They'd been hollowed out by volunteer crews who'd later decided they never wanted to field-dress one of the organic spacecraft again. Now they were shells, each one capable of holding one or two members of Luke's team. There was other wreckage in the bay as well, pieces of Yuuzhan Vong and New Republic ships, chunks of permacrete. The press of a button from Lando's bridge or a comlink carried by Luke would sever all those cables and activate an inertial compensator mounted on the bulkhead opposite the ramp door, shoving the debris and the insertion team out through the door. The work crew's final welding of the bulkhead between the forward and rear portions of the bay was what was generating the sparks. Lando approved. He wanted that bulkhead to be strong. He didn't need debris to come crashing through to wreck his B-wing. He wasn't as familiar with B-wings as he'd like to be, but the vehicle should be able to get him and his droid back home, if he could reach the docking bay from the bridge. If he had time. If not, he'd be launching in an escape pod. He'd be captured by the Yuuzhan Vong. He'd be enslaved and tortured. No, he decided, if he couldn't reach the B-wing, there would be no escape pod for him. He'd ride the wreckage of the Corvette all the way down to Coruscant's surface. And he'd look good while doing it. Lando was on the bridge when Luke's team came up the temporary ramp into the landing bay. It was Luke and Mara, Tahiri, several of the Wraiths, whom he'd barely met, the bald one, the tall one, the Deveronian, the skinny bearded man, and the severe-looking woman, and a final surprise, Danny Quee. He shouldn't have been startled. He should have known that the persistent scientist would have insisted on being a part of the mission to find out what was going wrong with Coruscant's planet shaping, to learn whatever she could of the Yuuzhan Vong. R2-D2 waited at the bottom of the ramp. Lando knew that Luke wasn't taking him along, and why. The astromech droid wasn't mobile enough to navigate the difficult terrain the insertion team expected to face, and would certainly be an instant victim of Yuuzhan Vong wrath if captured. R2-D2 tilted backward, as if leaning back to stare up at Luke, and Lando could imagine the plaintive noises and musical tones he'd be making. Luke stopped at the top of the ramp, still within range of R2's holocam view, and turned back to his droid companion. His gesture was conciliatory, reassuring. "Pretty sad, eh?" Lando asked. His own droid companion, YVH-11A, looked up from its sensors. "Sad," it confirmed, but without inflection. "Ready to face the danger?" "I am ready," YVH-11A said. "Of course I am ready. I am programmed to be ready. Always ready, never uncertain about facing danger." Lando gave the droid a little frown. It sounded as though the combat droid had picked up some conversational mannerisms from a protocol droid like C-3PO. But YVH-11A still didn't have the linguistic modules to help him develop idiosyncrasies like that. Oh, well, something to worry about when they got back. He hit the switch on his comm unit. Borlias Control, this is record time, ready for takeoff.
We'll give you the word. The assault is anticipated within the half hour.
Hey, what odds am I getting that I'll blow up before getting out of the atmosphere?
About 1 in 100, sir.
I'll put 1,000 credits on surviving at least to orbit.
I'll take that, sir. I could use 10 credits.
How do you collect if you win?
Silence answered him. Lando grinned at YVH-11A, but the droid merely stared back at him, humorless.
The alarm cut through the biotics building, the temporary docking bays built outside it, the kill zone surrounding it. Pilots scrambled for their starfighters. Mission controllers reached their stations and began coordinating the units they managed. Jaina, racing for the special operations docking bay, skidded to a halt as a large man staggered into her path and turned pleading eyes on her. He was young, not unpleasant-looking, but awkward of posture, with mussed hair and eyes more bloodshot than she'd ever seen in a human, worse than her father, Orlando, after the most extravagant night of drinking.
"Do you need help?" she asked.
The big man shook his head. "I'm going to die."
His words were slow, pained.
"Then you definitely do need help," she brought out her comlink. All around her, pilots and crew ran into the docking bay and toward vehicles parked in the kill zone.
"I'm a Yuuzhan Vong spy, and I'm going to die. I'm supposed to capture you now, with the bugs in my pocket, and carry you to the edge of the kill zone. But I'm not going to."
"Thank you." Jaina switched on the comlink. "Twin Sons leader to control. I'm in front of the Special Ops docking bay. I have a civilian male here. He's experiencing distress and needs medical help right away."
"Acknowledged, Twin Sons."
"I've won." The big man offered her a broad, idiotic smile. Blood suddenly began pouring down from his nose, running over his lips, spilling to the ground.
"I don't have to do what they say. All they can do is kill me."
"Of course," she edged around him. Whatever his situation, she had to get to her X-Wing.
"I took the bug off your X-Wing," he called after her, "so don't worry."
"I won't," she promised, then turned to race after her pilots.
Tam watched her go. He knew she hadn't believed him. Everyone had seen shell-shocked refugees here after Coruscant's fall. He must look just like one of them.
It took him a long time to work his way through that thought. With every beat of his heart, another spike of agony was pounded through his skull and into the deep portions of his brain. There wasn't room for brain matter anymore. That had to be why it was so hard to think. But it was important that some people believe him, so they could finish undoing what he had done since arriving on Borlias. He could see medical personnel running toward him now. He'd never be able to make a full confession to them, not before the pain ate completely through him and he died. But he didn't need to. He reached into his pockets. His right hand drew out the jelly-like container, still half full of Yuuzhan Vong bugs. His left drew out the data card, the one on which he'd written, "In the event of my death." Suddenly he was looking at the sky. He hadn't felt the impact of falling. He put the bag and data card on his chest, where they were sure to be found. Then the sky was full of faces, men and women saying things he couldn't understand. He smiled at them to reassure them. Maybe they could save him, but if they couldn't, it was important they understand that he didn't blame them, that he wasn't mad. He was still trying to form the words to tell them this when unconsciousness claimed him. Jaina dropped into her X-Wing's cockpit. Still somewhat rattled by the encounter with the madman, she began her power-up checklist. Her astromech, a gray-white R2 unit with burgundy lines and decorations, was already in place. "Hey, you," Jaina said. "I never asked. What's your name?"
Her comm board trilled, and she looked to find a line of text appearing on it.
"I don't have a name," My designation is R2B3. No name? That's terrible. You can't become famous without a name. Do you want one?
That would be good.
How about Cappy? For a friend of mine, a pilot named Capstan.
I am Cappy.
All right, Cappy, give me the engine readouts.
Jaina went through her checklist with her customary speed. This time, though, she didn't push herself to finish. She knew that Jag would be done before she was. She no longer had to look through his viewport for confirmation. On the other hand, when she was done, she did look. She saw him leaning back in his pilot's seat, relaxed. She gave him a smile and a thumbs up. He pulled his helmet off and gave her a return smile. It was a half-smile, the left side of his mouth, brief but encouraging, for her alone. Then he pulled his helmet on again and was the anonymous pilot once more. The expression caused something to flutter in her stomach.
Have to remember, she told herself.
He may have been raised among the Chiss, but he's still full-blooded Corellian. A few meters away, Kip Duron also saw the exchange of looks. He pulled his gaze away and concentrated on his diagnostics readout instead. Since Hapes, Jaina had kept Kip at arm's length. She'd kept everybody at arm's length. Now it was obvious that Jag Fell had gotten past her guard.
So what's it going to be? He asked himself.
Show him up? Let her interest in him run its course, then be on hand when she needs a friend to console her? He wished he disliked Jag. That would make things easier. Another voice, another thought intruded. Maybe you ought to figure out what she is to you before you make any decisions. He grimaced. That required more honesty than he wanted to experience, because he knew he wasn't in love with Jaina Solo. He just liked being around her. She was intelligent, talented, brave, beautiful, strong in the Force, important to the New Republic. He could make her happy. Why did he want to? He suspected it was because she hadn't been happy, and her pain, which he'd felt through the Force every time they'd connected, called to him. Even when she'd fooled herself into thinking she could make it go away by keeping the whole universe at bay. But he'd been interested in her before the loss of Anakin and Jason, so why? Maybe it was because of Han. He owed Han so much. From the time years ago when they'd met, from the help Han had offered in bringing Kip back from the dark place he'd been in, when he'd destroyed whole worlds, he might not be alive if not for Han. Make Jaina happy, make Han happy. It was a simple formula. Besides, he had repaid that debt, or some of it. He'd helped Jaina come back from the steps she'd recently taken toward the dark side, and would continue to help as long as she needed him.
Twin sons, too.
That was Jaina's voice, artificially sweet, and it jolted Kip out of his reverie.
Yes?
Status, please?
All the other little twin sons are ready to go.
He did a quick scan of his readouts. He'd finished his checklist automatically, as if on autopilot, and hadn't even registered the fact. Ready to go. Sorry, great one. Lift off in 10, 9, 8. Kip smiled ruefully to himself. So much for acting like a Jedi master.